You're listening to a UC San Diego podcast.
Okay. Thanks all for coming. I know you don't have to. I know you have other places to be, so I won't keep you too long in the last lecture. Hope you all had fun with assignment two and getting it in on time. I did check the submissions at about 11 p.m. last night. There weren't that many of them, so hope you all made it. Okay, so today we'll finish off on temporal dynamics and finish off on the course altogether. So basically we're looking at temporal models on Monday just as a way of, and today just as a way of revisiting all the material throughout the course. So really, how does things like regression, classification, text, social networks, whatever, how does it change once we revisit it with temporally evolving data in mind? So what we looked at so far were things like regression, where the goal is to predict a quantity which is the next event in a sequence. So you have some sequence that's made up of, say, real valued quantities, something like the value of some stock or the daily weather or the traffic you see on your website, and you'd like to predict the next value based on all the previous values. We saw these models called autoregression, which would allow you to build a feature vector out of the previous values, and you could learn the extent to which, say, yesterday's web traffic predicts today's traffic versus how much does the traffic 7 days ago predict today's traffic or the traffic a month ago predict today's traffic. So you could learn the extent to which things like recency or periodicity are good at predicting the next value in a sequence. We saw classification, so we looked at dynamic time warping, which is a very simple nearest neighbor approach that basically fits a similarity function between two time series. And most of what we talked about on Monday was really temporal recommender systems. So really did this case study of this paper by Karen, which was essentially describing, roughly speaking, the winning solution to the Netflix prize before everything got overly complicated. So today we'll just look at the last two topics, one of which is text, which we looked at back in weeks 5 and 7. So really this is another case study of a particular paper that was trying to say, how do the topics people have used, how do those change over time? So looking at things like political discourse or the text used in academic papers or the topics people discuss in institutional emails. So how do those change throughout time, and can we come up with some high-level analysis of how the topics that people like to discuss have changed? And finally, social networks, where we'll revisit some of these properties we saw in week 8, but we'll look at them in terms of networks where we can observe exactly when every single edge shows up. So in week 8, we really looked at static networks, where we observed the entire network, but we didn't see how it actually formed. So now we'll revisit those topics where we see the formation time of every node and the formation time of every edge, and we'll see if that's kind of consistent with the results in the random graph models we developed previously. Okay, so yeah, on Monday we were looking at these things like autoregression, so predict the next value given the previous one. We saw this could also be a nice way of generating plots. So this is just sort of the simplest sliding window type model run on this beer advocate data. So predict the next rating given the previous 10,000. It's a very lightweight and simple way to discover sort of long-term trends in the data set, as well as things like seasonal or periodic effects. Much more effective way to generate plots than just doing a scatter plot, something like this. I did look at some assignments with plots like this, so I guess I know who's showing up to the lectures. And we looked at this time series classification problem, really just a nearest neighbor algorithm. This was called dynamic time warping, but really just running good old longest common subsequence algorithm, which all of you remember, on time sequences as a means of doing nearest neighbor classification. So this longest common subsequence algorithm gives you a sort of similarity function between two sequences. So if this was, say, I don't know, an audio sequence of a person pronouncing some word, and this was another audio sequence of a word whose label you knew, you could just say, well, amongst my whole data set of labeled utterances, which one is this most similar to? And that's probably the word the person's saying. So it can be used for things like speaker identification or speech to text, things like that. So then you find that even if this person was speaking at half the speed of this person, this longest common subsequence algorithm would learn, oh, well, I should just sort of drop half the samples from this slower utterance in order to maximize the similarity. So it's kind of flexible to different speeds or something between the two time series. Okay, so yeah, mostly what we talked about was this temporal modeling of the Netflix prize. So we made a pretty strong argument as to why modeling temporal dynamics is so important in recommender systems. Kind of the surprising result here was that this very simple model, which just had temporally evolving bias terms, by capturing the temporal dynamics with high enough fidelity, they were able to beat Netflix's existing solution at the time the Netflix prize was started. So, you know, we had this paradigm we saw in week four for recommender systems where we were learning these very complicated compatibility functions between user and items. The fanciest such model was beat just by using temporally evolving bias terms. And, yeah, of course, the winning solution to the Netflix prize included both. It included temporally evolving bias terms and temporally evolving latent factors as well. Okay, so onto some text. In weeks 5 and 7, we looked at bags of words models. So you all remember these, very simple model of text that basically just ignores syntax altogether. So this is a review that has words randomly reshuffled. It would have exactly the same bag of words representation as the original review. So really just counting words, ignoring syntax altogether. But that can be very good for sort of sentiment analysis type tasks where just the appearance of certain words and not really their context or their whether they're next to another particular word or syntax, basically, where those kind of things aren't needed, but sort of certain words are very predictive that maybe a review is very positive or negative. And these are some examples from beer reviews. We also looked at dimensionality reduction as it applies to text and as it applies to top bag of words representation in particular. So we saw latent semantic analysis, which was essentially PCA applied to bags of words. And we saw topic models as well, which is essentially a probabilistic version of this. And all we're going to talk about today is how have people adapted this type of model so that the topic use can also be temporally evolving. So think of how could you model bags of words as accurately as possible when you also see what is the time point at which each word was written. And social networks, yeah, we looked at all kinds of things. We studied social networks. We looked at power or degree distribution. So this basic observation that in real-world social networks and other types of networks as well, there tend to be a few individuals who have very, very high degree, and then this long tail of individuals with lower degree. And we came up with random graph models that would emulate that property. We also looked at, well, the related idea of some nodes being influential. Obviously, in something like a citation network, there are a few nodes with very high degree, like Paul Erdős. This is mathematical collaborations. But he's not just a good mathematician because he has high degree. He's a good mathematician because he writes papers with other good mathematicians. Okay, so we came up with some definition of authoritativeness that captured that sort of circular logic. And we looked at small worlds, this idea that in very, very, very large networks, there are always shortest paths between people, and we tried to come up with random graph models that are consistent with that, and we looked at this fun result about strong and weak ties. So you can come up with some model that explains this weird phenomenon that we talked about, that you probably found out information about your last job you got or something through an acquaintance rather than a close friend, and the idea is, well, you probably found out about a job through somebody who connects you to a distant part of the network and distant information. And if you make some simple assumptions about how friendships form, then you can sort of demonstrate that this person who connects you to a distant part of the network is likely to be an acquaintance rather than a close friend. So, yeah, we'll just revisit a few of these ideas, mostly power laws and small world phenomena, by looking at data sets where we observe the formation time of every single node and every single edge, which I think we didn't have back in week 8. Advertising, well, I won't revisit that too much. It was only last week. We all remember, except those of you who missed the lecture because of Thanksgiving. You can watch the video. But we also did some temporal modeling last week anyway, so there's not too much more to discuss. Basically, we were trying to come up with these algorithms that would handle essentially budget constraints between users and advertisers, where a user can see only so many ads and an advertiser can afford to show only so many ads. We kind of had to model temporal dynamics in that kind of setting because in any realistic scenario, you have users showing up to websites or performing queries one at a time, and you need to recommend advertisements to them immediately while still handling those budget constraints. So this is what these banded algorithms or AdWords were already doing. So no need to cover temporal dynamics too much this week. Let's just move on to text and then some social networks, and then I can talk about some assignments. Okay, so we remember our bag of words representations. Nothing too deep here. We have some document. We're going to come up with a very, 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 very high dimensional way of representing the document just by counting for every single word in the English dictionary, how often did it appear. Okay, so this document contains the letter or the word R 150 times, so on for every single other word. It's kind of a very naive representation. We did a bunch of tricks in week 5 to kind of make it work by filtering stop words and capitalization and punctuation and counting word popularity, whatever. So we get some high-dimensional feature vector that describes a document. And we also saw in week 7 how we could apply dimensionality reduction techniques to these bag of words representation. So we saw two ways. They're very similar to each other. One was latent semantic analysis. One was a topic model, which are just trying to model as accurately as possible a bag of words matrix. So each row of the matrix is a document. Each column of the matrix is a word. And then each entry is saying how much did that document use that word. And we'd like to kind of compress or model that matrix as accurately as possible. So one way was basically latent semantic analysis, where we'd apply really just PCA to that giant bags of words matrix. The other way was a topic model, which is more or less a probabilistic version of the same thing. We had some funny algorithm where we rolled dice to generate words with some probability, whatever. Doesn't really matter. You can revisit that in your own time, but the point is the output of these models was some sort of low-dimensional representation of documents. So we would describe documents not just in terms of the individual words they used, like a bag of words would, but in terms of the extent to which they discuss each topic. So we're taking this document, which has a very high-dimensional bag of words representation, we're projecting it into some low-dimensional space, which says not how much it uses each word, but how much it uses words of some type or words of some topic. So to what extent does this document discuss action words or sci-fi words? And we came up with a few ways of automatically discovering these topics. You remember our, or you don't remember our weird generative algorithm for this. We had some strange random process where you roll some dice and that tells you what topic you're going to discuss, and then you roll some dice when you have what word you're going to discuss from that topic. That's how LDA worked. The other algorithm and latent semantic analysis was just PCA. So one sort of this compression type idea like we saw in week 3. The other one is this sort of probabilistic model. But they're both kind of trying to get at the same thing. They're trying to learn a low-dimensional representation, which is describing a document in terms of topics. And then each topic is associated with a set of words that are used in similar contexts. Okay, so two vectors, really. A topic vector for each document, and then a word vector for each topic. So what is the low-D representation of the document, and what are the sort of set of words that are used in similar contexts? So I'll let you go over the details, but given some low-dimensional representation, what we want to do today is say we have these low-dimensional representations that describe topics. Can we study how those topics have changed over time, or the usage of those topics has changed over time? So this is a nice paper, Topics Over Time. So you can imagine where and why this happens. If you look at things like conference proceedings, then you'll see that the neural networks topic kind of went away and was replaced by some support vector machine topic, and you know, now the neural networks topic has come back. You can look at much longer term things like political discourse. I think one of the data sets they had was State of the Union addresses or something like that. Obviously words about, or topics about science and technology are much more prominent than I don't know, the Panama Canal or something like that. And they also looked at emails within an institution. So this was just looking at a 1 year or even slightly shorter than 1 year period. And there are obviously certain topics that come and go at a certain time of the year. Okay, so they take regular old LDA, whether you remember the process or not, and they only add one thing to it, which is this beta distribution. So I think I have a picture, which is a better way of describing it, actually. So all they do is, in addition to having some random process which generates the topics and which generates the words, they have another random process which generates the timestamp according to a beta distribution. I mean, whatever. It's a weird detail. The beta distribution looks like this. It's got two parameters, alpha and beta. So it's x to the power alpha minus 1, 1 minus x to the beta minus 1 divided by the beta function of alpha and beta. I don't know. It's some weird distribution. The specifics actually don't matter too much. Really, it's just a nice function that, given two parameters, can take a variety of realistic shapes that capture how topics might evolve over time. So by setting the parameters alpha and beta properly, we can come up with all these different sort of functions that might describe how topics evolve. So alpha and beta equals a half, looks like this. That would correspond to a topic that was really popular, disappeared, and then became popular again, where sort of zero is the start of our data set and one is the end of our data set. Whereas if you set alpha and beta equal to 2, that would be the opposite. That would be a topic that was unpopular, became popular, and then disappeared again. Or if you set alpha equal to 2 and beta equal to 5, then you get this shape here, which is basically some sort of burstiness, some topic that became popular suddenly and then just trailed off after a while. So, yeah, don't worry about the weird probabilistic form and the specific definition of this function. It's just a nice, elegant way of using just two parameters to fit a fairly flexible family of temporal evolution that might capture how real topics evolve. Okay, and then inference is done just as it was before. So they fit these beta distributions basically to a bunch of different data sets. The first one is political addresses. So you have some things that are not really discussed much anymore, like the Mexican War and the Panama Canal, whereas modern tech is discussed a lot more. So the blue bars here are how much that topic was actually discussed according to the data, and the green line is the fitted beta distribution. So it seems this sort of two-parameter distribution can actually capture many of the realistic ways in which topics evolve over time. So, you know, the Mexican War was some very sort of bursty dynamic where a topic was discussed for a few years and never again. Same with the Panama Canal. The Cold War kind of gradually became popular but then dropped off, and modern tech just kept growing exponentially. So this simple sort of two-parameter distribution can capture many of these realistic types of behavior. But our goal is still to estimate as accurately as possible some bag of words model plus a timestamp. Similar sort of thing. This is just email data from a particular institution. Maybe you can guess what institution it is. There's sort of this burst of discussion about faculty recruiting. You know, for those of you who don't know, faculty recruiting pretty much all happens between February and April at universities. So you see, this is a bit less than 1 year of data. I think this is starting at January 1st. And you can see when that topic was discussed. This is some paper that I was submitting. I guess it had a very similar deadline to the paper that these results are in. Some software package they developed and something about version control, I guess, which is relatively flat throughout time. Similarly, for conference proceedings, the idea of a recurrent neural network, it became hot, and then by 2005, no one cared anymore. Well, recurrent neural networks are back. It's been another 10 years since this paper was written, though. And I guess mid-2000s, game theory had just gotten really, really hot. This conference was NIPS, by the way, in case anyone cares. So this is sort of a more detailed representation of the same thing, where they're just sort of stacking for each point in time the extent to which topics would be discussed. So probability that a topic would be discussed, so it adds up to one. And you can see some nice things like neural networks kind of got fat, sort of got popular and then disappeared, and was kind of replaced by SVMs. And yeah, again, this is finishing 10 years ago. Okay, so that's topic over time, or a non-Markov continuous time model of topical trends, if you like. It's a very nice paper. It's just taking really those topic models, adding a couple of extra parameters to them to capture the realistic shapes of topical evolution and discover some very nice high-level trends about how topics evolve. All right, so finally, let's talk about some social networks and then look at some cool assignments. So we saw all kinds of things in the social networks lectures. There are a lot of things to cover. The big one, I guess, is models of network structure. So we were trying to come up with random processes that would generate realistic-looking networks. In particular, they generate social networks with as high fidelity as possible. And we started off with some very silly things, like just plonk down a bunch of nodes and then just throw edges randomly in the network, which is called an Erdős-Rényi random graph model. We sort of tried to analyze how that wasn't a realistic way how real networks would form. In particular, it didn't exhibit these properties like power laws that we know are ubiquitous in real-world networks. So we came up with more complicated processes. Essentially, we wanted something that would exhibit this rich-get-richer phenomenon. So our process was basically saying that nodes that already have a high degree are likely to have their degree increase. So we came up with this process that was designed to generate the web graph, basically, where each time a new web page shows up, it forms a link to an existing web page, but it does so in proportion to how many links that page already has. So pages with lots of links get more. That's a rich get richer effect, and it would nicely exhibit this sort of power law phenomena. We saw triadic closure in the strength of weak ties. This was the nice result about where you found your last job and small world phenomena and Hobson authorities, which I've already talked about a few minutes ago. So the question now is, what can we do if we see kind of the full temporal evolution of the network? What we were studying in week 8 was sort of a static graph. We had the entire network, like a snapshot of it, basically, and then we analyzed that snapshot. What we'd really like is to say, if we observe the order in which edges were created or the order in which nodes were created, we can see how these phenomena change as a function of time. So, you know, these random graph models we came up with were realistic in the sense that they produced the correct network statistics that we wanted, but they're not really how people form social networks, right? You don't show up to Facebook, make all of your friends in one go, and then never make any friends again. It might be a nice random graph model, but it's not how networks evolve over time. So if we can actually see the order of node and edge creation, is it going to be consistent with, or is it going to be somehow different from the random graph models that we already have? So there are two kinds of like evolution we could look at, sort of microscopic and macroscopic. So macroscopic would be things like high-order properties of the entire network, such as its diameter, so what's the shortest path between nodes on average in the entire network. Microscopic, which we can look at first, is going to be what happens to individual nodes. So when are you born, when do you die in a social network, and sort of when do you make friends, and how many friends do you make, things like that. Okay, so most basic property is, how does the number of nodes in a network change over time? So a few social networks here, Flickr, Delicious, Answers, LinkedIn, relatively old data, so 2008. Don't know if these plots are still accurate. But in all of them, the x-axis is just the age of the network since, you know, Flickr started 25 months before this data was collected or whatever, or at least since they started having a social network, and the number of nodes in that network, which is log scale. And there's, well, is there anything in common with these? Maybe not so much. So there seems to be no, all the plots look a bit different. There seems to be no one trend which really explains how social networks look, if you like. So, you know, these are all fitted. They will roughly fit some function, but they're all different functions. So this is an exponential function in Flickr, at least towards the most recent period when the data was collected. It was the number of nodes was growing exponentially. Delicious was growing roughly linearly, so there's a very high coefficient before the linear term. Answers is sort of sublinear, so there's a high coefficient before the linear term, but there's also a negative quadratic term, so that is going to somehow level off eventually. And LinkedIn was also growing exponentially. So I don't know what to make of that, except that all kinds of different things are happening. So there's no nice unifying property about how the number of nodes in a network is going to change throughout time. It depends. It could boom, it could die off, it could level off, whatever. So, you know, what do nodes in networks have in common in terms of the temporal evolution? So we'll go into a little bit more depth, not just how many nodes are there, but when do people make friends in social networks? So in our random graph models, everyone made all their friends all at once and then never made any friends again. Is that actually realistic or not? Is that what you do when you sign up for a social network? The answer is maybe somewhat. So here, the x-axis is the node age. So 0 is when you signed up for whatever social network that is, the same set here. And the y-axis is how many nodes, on average, people created on that day or during that week. So here there kind of is a little bit of a common pattern. So in all of these networks, there's a large value around 0. So during your first day or your first week of activity, you formed more friendships than you would form in any other week. Seems pretty natural. You sign up for a new social network, you make a bunch of friends immediately after you sign up. But in most networks, that gradually flattens off. But it doesn't flatten off to 0. It sort of flattens off to a constant. So you don't just suddenly create all your friends and never create any again. You first create a bunch of friends, and then you kind of level off to some stable point where you create friends constantly throughout time. Kind of the one outlier here is LinkedIn, where you still create a bunch of friends initially, but it doesn't level off. Rather, it drops off and then grows linearly or something like that. Any guesses why LinkedIn is funny or LinkedIn is different? Yeah? Yeah, I mean, I guess they're proactive, but that would kind of more explain a high constant rather than growth. Yeah, maybe you only log in because you're looking for a job, which I guess is an explanation for why there would be sort of you'd periodically look for more friends on LinkedIn, right? Yeah, it's to your advantage to have more friends. I mean, the other thing I think is just that each time you're looking for a job, you're more of a hotshot than you were last time. So you're becoming fancier. In LinkedIn, there is kind of this, I mean, this is not just people you click friend that person, but also people who click on you, right? So as you become more prominent in LinkedIn, more people are going to want to friend you, which isn't quite true for Facebook, right? People don't friend you on Facebook just because you have lots of friends, maybe a little bit, but That happens a lot on LinkedIn, right? Just the fact that you're some sort of fancy pants person or you're very prominent means other people want to connect to you, and that happens more and more and more as you become more fancy as you get older. Okay, so that's when do nodes form connections. The third question is how long does a node live? So what's kind of the, how long does it take before you stop forming any connections ever again? Where that's kind of defined as your death in the social network. So we're looking at the distance, the difference between the date of the last and the first edge creation. So the x-axis then is node lifetime. This is a node here who created their last edge 300 days after they created their first edge. And then the y-axis is, it's kind of just measuring the frequency of such nodes. So all of these numbers would add up to one, I guess. So it's saying, what is the probability that a node lived that long? And here we do see a pretty nice, consistent pattern of behavior. Basically, we see a power law. So this is a linear log plot. So they all have a sort of an abrupt drop off, where there's a very large number of nodes who have relatively short lifetimes. So they kind of do create the edges very quickly, or otherwise they just never really participate in the network. And then the there's some very long tail of people who are longer lived. Okay, so that's about all I wanted to say about microscopic evolution. So that's individual nodes. So when do they make friends? How long do they live? What is the number of nodes? What about some sort of global characteristics that look beyond individual nodes and say, what's the ratio between nodes and edges in a graph? So this is a different set of networks now, just because these results come from a different, I pulled them from a different paper. This is a couple of citation networks and a co-authorship network, and one about what's not social at all, it's an autonomous systems network. And we're looking at the number of nodes, like we did before, but rather than saying how does the number of nodes change over time, we're saying how does the number of edges change as a function of the number of nodes. So both of these things are increasing, but how do they increase in relation to each other? So this is kind of where things get a bit funny. We're saying how does the number of edges grow with the number of nodes? These are all log-log plots. They all look like basically a straight line. So it's linear on a log-log plot, which means it's actually an exponential function. So they all look like the number of edges is a constant times the number of nodes to some power. So the number of edges is growing exponentially with the number of nodes. And sort of critically, what's most interesting is that power is greater than 1. Okay? So if that power were exactly equal to 1, it would be saying nodes always create roughly a constant number of edges, which would, I think, be pretty natural, right? I think, yeah, on Facebook, human beings have 200 friends or acquaintances. So no matter how old Facebook gets, people are always going to have degree about 200. You know, it's kind of a natural assumption. But this is saying that's not the case. So it's saying that the number of edges grows faster. In particular, the number of edges grows exponentially with the number of nodes. So it grows like this. So this is just saying, the number of edges is proportional to the number of nodes to some power, and the power is going to be between 1 and 2. So 1 would correspond to this basic constant out-degree assumption, which is what you sort of traditionally assume, where people always have the same number of friends on Facebook, so they always form, they always end up with the same out-degree. The other extreme value it could take would be 2, so it must be between 1 and 2. 2 would be a fully connected graph. It would be saying the number of edges is equal to the number of nodes squared. That's as much as it could be, right? Everyone is connected to everyone else. So somehow the exponent must be between 1 and 2. 1 is what you might sort of traditionally assume, and some number larger than 1 is what you always get. So you always have a number of edges growing faster than the number of nodes. Okay, so This is saying that as the network gets older, people must be getting higher degrees. So people who show up to Facebook now must have higher degrees than the people who, or one explanation would be the people who showed up to Facebook now have higher degrees than people who originally showed up to Facebook. That's essentially what this plot is trying to show here. So it's sort of the year of publication or grant or publication again for citation and coauthorship networks. It's saying sort of when did the node, when does the node appear in the graph versus what is that node's average degree. And in all of these cases, it seems to increase, roughly speaking, linearly over time. So yeah, the average degree of a node is not a constant, but it's something that's growing, which is a pretty reasonable explanation for why the number of edges is going to grow exponentially with the number of nodes. Okay, so we see that the network is becoming denser. Yeah, which is just that same statement. Edges grow faster than nodes. So what does this mean for the diameter? So I showed this funny result on the Facebook graph, very briefly, I suppose, which actually said that as Facebook has gotten older, the shortest path distance between people has gotten smaller. So this small world phenomenon, which is captured by the diameter of the network, small worlds have gotten smaller, which is maybe a very surprising result. You would think as the world has gotten larger, there would be longer paths between people, and in fact, we saw the opposite. So is this related to this idea, then, of our networks becoming denser? Does this arise because edges form exponentially faster than nodes? So first of all, let's just look at the diameters. So we remember this graph from Facebook a couple of weeks ago. This is the same thing, seems to be true in a lot of types of networks. So on citation networks, coauthorship networks, on Facebook, whatever, as you see the network evolving throughout time, and you plot that against the network diameter, so sort of the longest, shortest path distance, you see that it goes down. You see that shorter paths exist between people. So, yeah, small worlds become smaller as the network grows. So why does this happen? I've given you this result, which says the number of edges is growing exponentially with the number of nodes. Is that enough? So if the network is becoming denser, if the edges are growing exponentially with the nodes, does that mean that small worlds must be getting smaller? You know, we're throwing in more and more edges really, really quickly. So maybe we're just creating shorter paths between people as a result of that process. So is this necessarily the case? Must this necessarily arise just due to the fact that edges grow faster than nodes? So we can build some random graphs and test this out. So we'll start with our Erdős-Rényi random graph, and we'll generate increasingly larger Erdős-Rényi random graphs, and each time we'll throw down a bunch of edges. But we'll follow this exponential growth pattern. So we'll say edges is proportional to nodes to the power 1.3. Okay, then this is exhibiting sort of exactly the same type of densification properties that we observed in real networks, and it's saying as the number of nodes gets larger, the number of edges gets exponentially larger. But then we plot the diameter, we find that no, actually, small worlds don't get smaller here. So even though the number of edges is growing exponentially with the number of nodes, the diameter is monotonically increasing, probably leveling off to some value. So it says, but no, it's not a consequence of densification. It's not a consequence of the number of edges growing faster than the number of nodes that causes networks to become small worlds, because here's a random graph model that exhibits densification but doesn't exhibit small worlds getting smaller. Okay, on the other hand, what about with the preferential attachment model, which has these power law properties? So we do the same thing. We build increasingly larger preferential attachment models and add a bunch of edges, and we add more edges exponentially with the number of nodes. This time we kind of do see the realistic result, which says that this time the diameter of the graph monotonically decreases. So with the preferential attachment model, with the number of edges growing exponentially with the number of nodes, we do see small worlds getting smaller. Okay, so just this property alone, densification, wasn't enough to guarantee that small worlds get smaller, but maybe the combination of these two things is. So this result is consistent with preferential attachment plus densification. So that's kind of the question. If we see not just densification, but also preferential attachment, is that going to be sufficient to explain why small worlds get smaller? So there's a very, very cute way of demonstrating this, which is to say, all right, we've observed densification in real networks, and we have some network that exhibits a power law degree distribution. So if we had another network that exhibited exactly the same power law degree distribution, would it also have small worlds? And there's a really cute way of generating another network with the same degree distribution. So you're given one network, which has some edges that look like this, and we'll randomly replace them by edges that look like this. Okay, this is my simple random process. I took two edges, A, B, and C, D. I replaced them by two edges, A, C, and B, D. So everyone, these four nodes, they all lost a friend and they all gained a friend. So the degree of distribution remains exactly the same. So it's a sort of trivial random process that randomly rewires the network but doesn't change the degree of distribution. So I repeat this simple trick millions upon millions upon millions of times, and I'm going to get a new randomly rewired network with the same degree of distribution. The question is, when I messed up the network in this way, will it still have a small world phenomenon? So if the old network was a small world, will the new one be a small world, even though I screwed up the edges? And the answer to this is yes. So we look at this shrinking small world property, which is the red dots on a real network, and we say if we randomly rewired the network, do the small worlds remain? And yeah, they get preserved exactly. So that's kind of our result, if you like. So you need these two things to explain why small worlds get smaller. One, you have densification. So the number of edges grows faster than the number of nodes. And two, you have power law degree distributions. If you have both of those things, that's going to be a sufficient condition to explain why small worlds must get smaller. Okay, so that's nearly all I wanted to say about social networks and how they sort of grow. There are some other interesting things that didn't quite fit about the evolution of social networks, not really the network here, but actually text that people are using. This is a nice paper about tracking, I guess, their tweets, or really memes as they evolve. So you can see the sort of lifetime or life cycle of some meme as it became very popular and then disappeared. Does anyone remember this one? What was that about? I mean, I remember it. I wasn't even in this country at the time. No? Who is the pig? Who's wearing lipstick? No one remembers, really? Sarah Palin, okay? You don't remember that? No. It was a big fiasco. During, I guess it was the, which one was Sarah Palin? That was 2008 election cycle? Yeah. So, what's that? Yeah. So, I don't know. Maybe no one remembers that now. It's an old result. Glad I didn't talk about it. Other similar things. This is kind of more like autoregression, but using social network data. So you're trying to predict some time series, but using some auxiliary source of data from a social network. So this is called Google Flu Trends. You're trying to use search query volume to predict how many people will have the flu. And they can sort of do this very accurately. It's a nice sort of tech report about this. And the kind of reason why this is nice is because the CDC or whoever releases this sort of real ground truth flu data doesn't do so until several weeks or several months after people exhibit those symptoms, whereas this query log traffic is generated in real time. So you can kind of see how many people have the flu before the CDC could do it. There's a nice similar result. It's a bit funnier about searches for recipes versus people showing up to the hospital, and they're plotting the sodium content of recipe searches throughout the year and comparing that to hospital admissions data for a certain condition. And yeah, at certain times of year, people are just eating way too much sodium, and maybe that's why they're going to the hospital. So that's called From Cookies to Cooks, which I think is a nice result. And those are all linked. So that's about it. I just thought I'd finish up by talking about some of the nice assignments I saw. I would have loved to have made all of you talk about them yourselves. Well, that's very difficult when it was only due a few hours ago. So I've just sort of looked through the assignments and tried to pick out some nice ones. Now, I always preface this by saying I have a strong bias to assignments that have a particularly attractive plot in them, even more so this year, since I really only had a few hours before the lecture to look through them. I kind of only looked at your assignment in detail if I found a particularly nice picture as soon as I opened the PDF. It certainly is not the only way to get good marks for this assignment. It's just how it ended up in my lecture slide. That is the process. Usually I have a couple of days to look these things over, but because I gave an extension in the spirit of Thanksgiving, I had to make some quick decisions. So, nice pictures. This was one about predicting when and where there are going to be Uber pickups, or is it Lyft? I forget which. Is there a difference? So they're trying to find hourly probable hotspot pickups. So they're sort of trying to cluster the geographical data and then associate some sort of time series to each of these geographical clusters, and looking at holiday trends as well. Sort of there's these nice heat maps. This is basically showing the hour and the day of week, and you can see some nice obvious trends here, like that Saturday and Sunday are pretty much like the morning of the rest of the week, but shifted by a few hours. So people are sleeping in or something like that. And, they told me it's very important to include their animation in this. So, you can see how the density of pickup traffic changes over time. And this is essentially, this is the data they're trying to predict, this heat map as it evolves throughout time. There's always some very nice sentiment analysis assignments. This one is about Yelp ratings. So they're trying to say which words are associated with very positive or negative opinions, so sort of unigrams, bigrams, and trigrams. People say things like, we'll never go back. But also a bunch of other things are in there too, like finding users who are similar and clustering them together, and those people are likely to rate things similarly, and sort of also temporal models of how people's sentiment changes as a function of time, geotags, so on and so forth. So like, sentiment analysis models with a bunch of extra stuff. This was maybe my favorite of all the Wordles. I don't know how you generate these things. There must be a better Wordle website than the one I used to be using. This is trying to predict hygiene feedback on Yelp restaurant data. So did a restaurant receive a positive or a negative hygiene rating? And certain words in the reviews of that restaurant can be good at predicting that. If you see Chinese mushroom or margaritas or ribs, maybe that's not going to be good, whereas, Starbucks is the most hygienic restaurant of all time. And I don't know what chowder is. Very hygienic, apparently. This one was looking at IRS data, which apparently you can get high volumes of, and trying to predict generosity. So generosity is essentially measured as what fraction of a person's income do they donate to charity according to their IRS data. So, and then plotting that as a function of zip code. It says San Francisco here, but I'm pretty sure that's LA. This one's correct. So this is sort of a heat map of the person's income, and this is a heat map of the person's generosity. So I guess the basic result here is kind of like with our helpfulness prediction on Amazon, the fraction of your income you donate grows with the amount of income you have. So rich people donate a lot of money. It's a great argument for the trickle-down economy, or maybe they're just better at hiding their income through charitable donations to the IRS. I don't know. I'm not really into US politics. There were some other things that I, you know, some sort of very advanced ways of doing things like classification. This is a way of, this is people using convolutional neural networks, which I think I talked about for all of about 5 minutes, so I guess you learned from somewhere else, to do multi-label classification. In this case, it was of black and white plankton images. Apparently, there's a lot of those available online, and there's 121 different labeled species of plankton. And they were training this very complex model, which is essentially a way of, I guess you can take Gary Cottrell's class if you want to know more about this, which is essentially a way of automatically learning features that are going to be good at this predictive task directly from the pixel level. So this is the same way I was doing sort of related clothing recommendation, if you remember that case study from weeks ago. You know, this is kind of the same idea, using deep networks to learn this notion of visual style by predicting coat purchases on Amazon, and you can kind of visualize which items are belonging to the same visual style based on which ones have these similar embeddings as learned by this type of feature generation function. Lots of crime data. Everyone's always into crime data. I guess there's lots of really good crime data available. A few people use this data set, I guess because it's an active competition on Kaggle right now, right? So here the idea is to do crime classification. You have some huge number of crime types, and you get data about the time and the day and the police department district and the address and the latitude, longitude, whatever, of, you know, when and where the crime is committed. And based on that, you have to build some predictor of, you know, a multi-label classifier of what class of crime you think that is. So there are a few people who did this. The highest one I found, which is from this report, was ranked 93 out of 878 on Kaggle, which I think is pretty impressive. Was anyone ranked higher than that? No. So that's reasonably difficult. I mean, some people are putting in some serious effort to winning that competition. So to get a project that gets near the top of the leaderboard is quite impressive. Okay, so that's about it for the assignment. A couple more administrative things. One is fill out those course evaluations. I guess about half of you already have. I'll have to say this during the last lecture, because I know if you really hated the class, you're not here. So let's cancel those people out. You know, they're very valuable to me, but I think they're valuable to other students also. As you may have noticed, I actually put my student evaluations online, which I guess most people don't do, and probably with good reason. So, you know, these are a lot of fun to read. I guess a lot of you have read them. You get some nice things like this. But, you know, in spite of being funny, they're actually pretty useful. So, you know, when you write on the board, it's very difficult to see. So if you could project your writing, that would be ideal. All right? So I did that. Was it ideal? You tell me. And, you know, like I said, a lot of you probably have seen these things. I was actually looking at my website traffic and my downloads for the last few months. This is my most downloaded academic paper. These are my course evaluations. So I don't know whether I should be happy about that or not, but someone's reading these things. Probably you read these things. I mean, seems to be the undergrad evaluations are more popular than the graduate evaluations, but whatever. I assume a lot of you read these and based on those decided whether or not to take the class. So please fill them out to the extent that they'll be useful to students next year. And finally, if you want more data mining, I'm organizing a workshop in just a few weeks. So this is a workshop about big graphs or something like that. Pretty much all the speakers I invited to this workshop are doing research on social networks. You know, it's free to register. Lunch is free. It'll be lots of fun. So I guess that's it for the year, and hope to see you there. Thanks. best of luck with those finals.
This has been a UC San Diego podcast. For more, visit podcast.ucsd.edu.